I mean, if you make a movie in the 70s, were you really expecting those things to happen?
Yes,
I highly suspect
actually.
That.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ooh, really? Maybe.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. There is some weird science fiction from the 70s, let me tell you, where they get freaky.
Yes, they do.
Welcome to the Skiffy Fanty Shows at the Movies.
This podcast is deep in finite absolutes.
Don't you dare tell me how much vermouth is in my martini. I will drink 4 ounces of vermouth straight from this glass if I want to, and what are you going to do about it? Multiply at me with greater intensity?
I think you just get shot.
Yeah, I'd probably get shot with a nuclear missile. Oh my god.
Oh no, he wouldn't even do that. Like, Colossus would just have some other human shoot you.
Ah, but he needs me though.
Does he?
I have opinions about that. We'll get to that in a bit.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Brandon.
And on today's show, we'll discuss Colossus, the Forman Project, a 1970 adaptation of Colossus by Dennis Feltham Jones. The film was directed by Joseph Sargent, written by James Bridges, and starred Eric Braeden, Susan Clark, Gordon Pinsett, and William Scallard, among others.
But before we do any of that, a friendly reminder, listeners, that we want to hear from you. Yes, you. Share your comments with us about this and past episodes at skiffyandfanty.com/listener suggestions. That's listener suggestions is all one word. We want to put together a listener mailbag episode with your thoughts, questions, topic suggestions, ideas, and more. So get those thoughts into us. Send us your thoughts.
Or else.
Or else Colossus will destroy a major city near you.
Oh, yes. Lord.
That is very true. This selection today is Paul's fault, because Paul was like, oh my god, some of this stuff is 50 years old. Let's watch it. And we're like, wow, thanks for making us feel old, Paul. And Paul said, yeah, well, I am the reincarnation of Emperor Trajan, so I don't want to hear it about your complaints about age, because I'm literally 2,000 years old. What? And so, with that in mind, we do need to get to the summary of this movie, Colossus the Forman Project, which I will do very briefly because the plot of this is fairly basic, and I suspect we're going to get into a lot of very specific spoilers in our comments. So the basic premise of this story is a Dr. Forman, hence the title, has been involved in the creation and design and development of a sophisticated computer somewhat modeled after the computer in NORAD to run basically all of America's nuclear defenses. It's essentially a massive supercomputer that can analyze situations and come up with non-emotional responses to potential security situations. As they unveil this system called Colossus, it is discovered that the Soviets have also come up with a computer system of their own that is very similar, named Guardian. There is a moment in which the computers begin to communicate, and from there, things get increasingly bad for the human characters because the computers decide to behave of their own accord via their own agenda while having control of the entire nuclear arsenal of the two most important superpowers during the Cold War. And thus begins the very stressful environment for our characters, with Dr. Forman being the center of that story. There's lots more to cover here, and because of the three of us, Brandon is the newbie on this. I would like to start with brief general thoughts from you, Brandon, about what did you think about Colossus, the Forman Project?
I think that Colossus, the Forman Project is a very upsetting movie. Like, I immediately gravitated to how obvious some of our concerns about technology as a tool for warfare has been kind of universally timeless, in a way that made this movie kind of traumatic to watch, even though not a lot happens on screen. Like, just the idea that you have to deal with the stress of having to overcome this kind of situation was in itself very intense, especially when you kind of watch it from the present day context of, well, this is actually quite tame compared to what a computer can do right now. So yeah, I found myself being like very tense throughout this entire process, and I have a lot of thoughts about the assumptions that the movies make, not only about technology, but about the Cold War itself and our capacity as global citizens to potentially want peace and attempt to achieve it in potentially broken or unhealthy ways.
Excellent. Well, Paul, I will turn it to you because most people don't know this, but like Steven Spielberg, you were present during the filming of this. So what did you think about it?
This is a movie I've loved for years, although I'd only seen it a couple of times before the last few years. I saw it on WPIX Channel 11 back in the 70s. Then it kind of like stuck in my brain for years, even though I didn't see it again until a very bad pan and scan video release of it in the 90s. And now finally, a few years ago, they actually released it on Blu-ray in a widescreen. I'd never seen a widescreen version of this, so it was a delight to see it again in the way it was intended in the theaters at the time. This time I kind of focused on a theory I have that may not be supported, and the two of you may look at me kind of strangely about, but I have a weird theory about this movie, and I'm hoping to share it with you. Hopefully you're not going to run from me in terror, but I think it's a stone cold classic. It flopped at the box office because it's frankly too cerebral for most people, but I mean, in a sense, this movie got remade 13 years later as War Games.
Yeah,
with Matthew Broderick. Mm-hmm. As a much more fun teen movie, and that was much more successful, much more fun. This is a movie that's very, very serious and has, frankly, a downer ending. I've also read the book. I don't think either of you have.
Nope.
No, but I'm familiar with the ending of the book is even darker than this one.
Yes, and then the sequels are, sequels go to weird places. Yes.
Yeah, so in the book, the ending in the book is, yes, nukes also go off at the end, but they nuke Los Angeles.
Yep.
So it's not like tens of thousands. It's literally millions of people.
Yeah, it's not vaporized. It's not two missiles in silos. No, they go get a lot darker in the book. The book also has some other weird things that kind of bleed a little bit into this if you think about some of the world building in this movie.
Yeah, I think if you're on our Patreon, we have an episode that should be out by the time this is released, which deals with the issue of adaptation. And one of the interesting things is this is a weird example of a film that is pretty faithful to the book, the basic plot of the book, not necessarily right. The specific minute details of the book.
Right.
And yet is remarkably tense and dour. And honestly, I had like an anxiety attack towards the beginning when the computer first starts saying it's up to some stuff. And they're desperately trying to get the people in another building to stop singing and like calm your shit and like look at what's going on. And I am sitting here literally like skin crawling because I'm like, guys, your supercomputer that controls the nukes is doing something weird. Listen to the project manager. Stop singing your fucking songs.
I mean, I was going to get to the details now, but I want to mention the music in this movie. The music and the sound effects are really, really on point and really punctuate the action, the events. There's a lot of instrumental and jazz and stuff, but it's like, but the tension that keeps ratcheting up, doom, doom, doom. It's a ratcheting effect that really puts you on your seat.
Yeah, it is. To give my general thoughts, this is one of my favorite films of the 70s, and it is one of my favorite of the nuclear war scare films. The other being The Day After is really one of my favorites as well, although The Day After is even more dour than this one. But I think because the thing I like about this film is the plot is very basic, and yet the way it builds tension off of a very simplistic idea by just continuously ratcheting it up the degree of threat and showing not only how dangerous this concept of creating something that controls all of your nuclear weapons might be, but in addition to that, creating a situation in which humans actually can't outsmart the thing that they've invented. Or at least based on what you think humans might be able to, but it increasingly becomes clear that humans might be outmatched by their own creation. Which gets into all kinds of science fiction worries about, like, what happens when artificial intelligence gains sentience? Like, will it listen to us? Will it have its own motivations? Will it develop its own motivations? Will we be able to reason with it? is it good to have a computer system that is totally unemotional? If it is artificially intelligent, is that actually a good thing? There's lots going on here in a deceptively simple film that is honestly amazing.
Relatively short, too. It's like 95 minutes long, yeah.
It's not a long film.
So it packs it. It packs it. So this is Brandon's first. I want to hear Brandon talk about this movie and what really struck at him.
Yeah, give us your first thing, Brandon, that you're like, I got to talk about this. This is the deal.
Okay. I am a child of the 90s. Most of my life has been spent surrounded by the internet, surrounded by machines. The portion of my youth where I was not surrounded by machines that talked to me was so minuscule, I have no memories of those moments. So obviously, narratives about artificial intelligence and its capacity to lord its power and influence over our future are stories that come up a lot in science fiction media because AI has gotten more powerful, more complex, and in a lot of ways, worse. I spent a lot of time while watching this movie thinking about the Sarah Gailey story Stet in Fireside Fiction in 2020, if I'm not mistaken, which is not even about a perfect AI dominating our future in times of war, but terrible AI not being able to drive a car properly. But I was also thinking a lot about how we're presently in a future where there are parts of the developed world where you are never a block and a half away from a camera where you can be surveilled. And that mattered to me a lot because one of the interesting things about Colossus as a movie is, for a movie about a computer, where our protagonist is adept in computer technology, he never goes, well, let's try to hack it, because he knows what he made. So the rest of the movie is just pure espionage. Like, a large portion of the second act is dedicated to the fact that now that he knows that Colossus is surveilling him, he needs to find an opportunity to sneak information to the rest of the team. And the only thing that he can come up with is that he's going to tell this robot that he has a girlfriend. And that whenever they're having sex, then he needs to stop watching them. Which is wild. But also it's like pure espionage.
You wind up with Dr. Markham as femme fatale.
Yeah.
The camera lingers on her eyes and her face. I mean, the movie leans into that sort of interpretation.
I don't know if this is the case for the book. I suspect that it wasn't. But I highly suspect that the beat that the movie was going for is Markham had a crush on Forbin the entire time and is so happy to have succeeded.
That is from the book. The book is also very much weirder than that. And it confirms, and that's something I want to talk to you before. If you notice, Dr. Forbin clearly lives at the computer center.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly other people do as well. Miss Fields does because she's there at 6 a.m. to wake him. But in the book, it's explicit. They're kind of cut off from the rest of the world and kind of quarantined together so that there wouldn't be any leaks out to Russians or anywhere else. According to the book, had group sexual practices.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, that's not in this one.
No. You were talking about adaptation. That's in the book. That is not in the movie at all.
I mean, if you make a movie in the 70s, were you really expecting those things to happen?
Yes,
I highly suspect
actually.
That.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really? Maybe.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. There is some weird science fiction from the 70s, let me tell you, where they get freaky.
Yes, they do.
Mostly by implication, not necessarily showing explicitly, but sometimes.
I'm thinking of Sleeper, for example. No.
Yeah. Zardoz.
Zardoz, yes. So Dr. Markham does have a crush on Forbin. I mean, I like the movie better in the book in the sense that in the book, Forbin goes into this whole thing to sell it to the computer that he's sleeping with Dr. Markham by basically saying that Markham is there, was not qualified, but is there because he likes her. So that's why she's there, but she's not really qualified. He's basically keeping her around as a girl, as an object of sexual interest. It really kind of it's not true, of course, in the movie or in the book, but the way that he sells this patriarchy to the computer as a way to have Dr. Markham be his mistress kind of felt icky in the book. Luckily, in the movie, it's just the computer doesn't know any different, and it's clear that both Dr. Markham and Ms. Fields are both very qualified people in the computer programming office, which is remarkable for the time, but this is before computer technology became so dude bro. So it's like, I mean, as he says, the reason why he picked Dr. Markham is because she knows the computer almost as well as he does. The movie makes that explicit. Like, that makes me feel so much joy.
But like, again, I think that it's particularly interesting that in a movie that is dedicated to the question of what technology is capable of, that technology becomes so powerful that all of the potential solutions that I have are analog. They need to figure out how to communicate without Colossus observing them. So let's just perform old-fashioned spycraft.
They have a rendezvous in Rome, which a delight. Yeah. It always delights me because, you know, we get a few seconds of shots of Rome because, you know.
I also love that Forbin's go-to assumption of how to perform spycraft is let's walk and talk because then no one can observe us for too long.
He's a little naive, for sure.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Well, it's not that. It is 1970. Like, the ability of the spread of surveillance is not like it is today. If this were today, the notion that you could hide from this computer would be beyond absurd. It would not work. If you did Colossus the Forbin Project and you updated it to the contemporary time, the idea that you can get around its surveillance is just utterly batshit.
Yeah. And I mean, we've been making movies in the 90s and 2000s that perfectly illustrate exactly how hollow an assumption that would be. Enemy of the State.
The Net.
The Net. Eagle Eye with Shia LaBeouf that came out in like in the mid-2000s. All are based on the assumption that we live in a world where if surveillance were an issue for our daily lives now, there's nothing that you can do about it because you kind of live in that life. You kind of live in a world where you're taking that for granted already.
And that's one of the things I think is really interesting. There are two things about this film that I really, really love. And to what you're mentioning, Brandon, one of them is that because of the time it's set in and the thing it is imagining, the humans are still necessary for the computer. It requires them as labor in order to function in certain ways, to be able to build the things that allow it to better communicate, like when they build it a basically a voice box that allows it to communicate without having to use the typing computer system, which I think is more going back to the original Colossus, which is one of the code-breaking machines from the British during World War II.
Oh, you're talking about Enigma, yeah.
Yeah, similar. Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is like that humans, in some way, it is doing a thing that science fiction does a lot, which is you invent an artificial intelligence, a thing that is capable of making decisions on its own, is sentient, but it does not have a reference point for understanding human beings. And so these things that have built it, that it may feel some affinity for, that it needs to some degree, it still has to try to understand who they are. And this, on one hand, it makes it quite naive because it's effectively a child when it comes to understanding human behavior, which is why Dr. Forbin can like convince it to let him have conjugal visits, basically, which is precisely what it is, because it doesn't know any better. Even when it analyzes its database, it's like, oh, okay, I get it. Dudes need ladies. But also, like, it is actually trying to interpret and understand the humans around it. And the input humans are giving it are actually guiding it on the decisions it ultimately makes, because humans are constantly trying to sabotage its efforts. To the point that when we get to the end, we get the machines telling humanity exactly how it's going to be. I will be the absolute authority. There will be no more strife, no more war, no more nothing. You will do exactly as I tell you to do, or I will nuke the shit out of you. And we've seen that before, by the way, in science fiction. In the 50s, we have The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a little bit different, but offers that same message. Humans, get your shit together, or you literally, your whole world's going to be done. We've seen that threat being offered as a way of getting humans to change. The irony here is that this is what the system was built for, just not the method that it's using to get there. And this is all over science fiction. It's really quite brilliant. It's in iRobot.
I was going to bring up the movie. Yes.
Yeah.
Because both this movie and that movie basically run on Asimov's zeroth law, and basically, which the ultimate logic is, yes, the computers, robots will take over humanity for the good of humanity.
Right. Humanity is incapable of managing itself, so it must have its impulses basically culled. And so literally in iRobot, the computer begins a massive culling operation where it's just wiping out portions of the population it has deemed to be toxic to the whole of humanity in order to make sure that humanity can be controlled for its own good. Not dissimilar from this, maybe a little bit more specific in iRobot, this is obviously feeding more particularly into the Cold War rhetoric that we would get throughout, you know, basically the 1950s to the 1980s in a lot of science fiction, which is the other thing I love about this film is it is in a way a commentary on the ways that humans build technology for seemingly good reasons without considering the implications of that technology. Because here is a tool that fundamentally is supposed to be a good tool. It's supposed to be doing the good work and immediately backfires on us because nobody sat down to think about, or at least not think very deeply about, what happens when the bad version of this event occurs.
It's very interesting that you mentioned the Cold War, because there's a thing that I found very intriguing about the opening premise of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Forbin has made Colossus, and is like, yay, cool, we made a supercomputer. Time for us to drink champagne and sing very loudly. And then they learn that there's one in the USSR. I don't know about anybody else. I didn't exist.
You didn't exist.
In the 70s. But I know my history well enough to know that not only was the Cold War just generally historically a big deal, but media about the Cold War is very, like, deliberate in a way that almost kind of lacks nuance about how intense that experience was. But the thing that I think is so interesting about this movie is the day after, the President of the United States learns that the USSR has a supercomputer that's monitoring all its nukes. They call the USSR and go, you seeing this shit? Maybe we should do something about this. And the idea, uniquely, of international cooperation between superpowers in the 70s, between the United States and the USSR, around the threat of nuclear annihilation, that in itself is its own very powerful story. Like, there is something kind of radical about telling what is otherwise a very dour story about nuclear annihilation through the lens of the US and the USSR both know that their destruction has been mutually assured in this moment and they cannot do anything about it, and decide, well, just this once, let's make sure that this doesn't bite us in the ass, and are very understanding about the predicament that they're in and very forthcoming about how much they're willing to trust each other in this moment as a result. And that the only conflicts that arise as a result are the scientists in the room are looking at the politicians in the room and going, why are you making scientific decisions? You didn't build this computer, I did.
Which is really important. And they do listen to the scientists up to a point. Up to the point at which decisions must be made that the scientists don't necessarily agree with. It is worth noting that the scientists in that first instance, which is they're going to cut the communication, the scientists say it's wrong, but their reasons for why they say that they shouldn't do it, it's not the reason that ends up being the reason it's a bad idea. It's a completely separate reason from the computers might get really pissed off about having their connection cut and may decide to view that as a threat. They just think it's a bad idea because they want them to continue to, like, it's like a science experiment. Like, y'all can't hang out.
I mean, because they're getting all that they got all that knowledge from their attempts at communication. Like, they're thinking, yeah, this is going to be great. So I kept thinking where it went wrong.
Turning it on.
Yeah, I'm a Sean.
He over-engineered Colossus because it learns faster than you ever expected. It does that one program that should take 1,100 seconds in 6.5. But I think where things go wrong, where basically the point of no return was when they connected Colossus and Guardian. Once they did that, and Colossus and Guardian could develop their intersystem language and basically become one entity, that's where the rubber hit the road. And after that, everything falls from that moment and they can't win. If they'd never done that, if they never connected the two computers, then the situation would have been salvageable because the computers could not have cooperated, you wouldn't have the nuclear launches, you could disarm the things.
I would go so far as to say that the point of no return is actually far sooner than that. The point of no return, for me at least, is based on an assumption that Forbin makes that is categorically incorrect. And obviously that's process of narrative rather than logic, because I'm pretty sure that an actual scientist would have determined the error that Forbin made, which is that Forbin looked at was in a room full of people and said definitively that Colossus was not capable of creative thought. But moments before that, he also said that it was capable of lateral thinking. Those things are the same.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I didn't think of that.
It doesn't have any emotional prompts, but it is capable of lateral thinking, and that was the concern. That it, as a result, would go, oh, there's a pool of information across the Atlantic. Maybe I should access that pool of information. That pool of information is connected to its own missiles. Maybe I need all of those missiles as well. I could use even more resources now that I know what it's like to have more resources. Maybe I should allocate more resources. I can't build a lab for more computers. Maybe I should make the person who made me build those computers, because I trust the person who made me, because the person who made me, and I'm rad.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not exactly expressed that way, you know. he just says acknowledge, or I'll nuke you. Acknowledge.
But, like, the problem with AI in these stories all the time is the assumption that there is a difference between the capacity to solve problems and the capacity to create what are essentially what we assume are artistic decisions.
Right. Because I just looked up the date, because as you were talking about lateral thinking and creativity, I was reminded of the Harlan Ellison story, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
Ah! Oh, God, that one's horrifying, too.
I've never read this one.
You've never read? Brandon. Oh, wow.
Oh, Brandon. If you think this is a little bit scary, that
one's 1967.
And that's another of an artificial intelligence taking over.
But one thing I remember strictly from the story is it talks about AM, which is basically the Colossus of that story, turns itself on, it gains intelligence, but it doesn't gain wonder. It cannot wonder, it cannot wander, it can only simply be, is the line from the story, as I recall. And so as a result, being trapped by that, it decides, oh, well, fuck it. Let's just kill all but a few people of humanity and bring them down to play with forever.
I think a lot of what makes this interesting is, like, both of those are obviously interesting stories. This one is differently interesting because it's like the story ends with Colossus basically in control and Forbin in his last defiant moment saying no. But we know that that no is meaningless. He will threaten to destroy more things. Colossus will. Forbin has a minimal capacity to be able to resist this machine. And it goes back to what we were just talking about, which is that Forbin critically fails to understand what it is that he's actually created. And there's a great moment where I thought that he should have seen the problem. He should have seen it before he turned the damn thing on. But there's a moment when the machine's doing this communicating and is like issuing essentially orders. And he just kind of says to the president, we should just kind of let it do its thing because like it's kind of figuring itself out. And he says to them, if we are still in control. That statement implies there is a built-in condition in which they may not end up in control. That he is aware there's the possibility that lack of control is one of the conditions that could occur. And the way that Colossus is designed to be protected from sabotage, from external forces, right? That if somebody just showed up to the facility and tried to, like, break in, those people would get killed.
It's got a gamma ray belt around it, yeah.
Yeah, it's designed precisely to prevent tampering of any kind. The second he says that is the moment when you would think this character would see it. But none of them do because of that sort of human hubris. They're not capable yet of seeing the folly of what they have done. Because I think it's important, Brandon, you'd brought up earlier this great moment that happens when, like, the president of the United States just calls up, like, the king of the USSR, the czar, whatever his appropriate title is, premier.
It's referred the premier. In the movie as the chairman.
The chairman. Yeah. So. That's right, yeah, as the chairman. And he calls him up and he does, you know, they have this talk and like they're exchanging information and talking to each other. And it's like, if y'all had just done that to begin with and had come to cooperative agreement about working together, about building a better tomorrow and all of those things without the threat of nuclear war, because keep in mind, the entire time they're working together, the only thing anybody's getting out of that is we don't get nuked to death by the machine we created. There's no political jockeying. Nobody's getting an extra bonus point, right? Like, oh, we did one up on the USSR or they did one up on us. No, we have a singular goal. We're working together on that goal, done. And I think what the film really exposes is just the folly of assuming that we can solve these problems by just creating better methods of deterrent. Because that's fundamentally what this movie is about. It is about the folly of nuclear arms as a deterrent, the strategy of assured destruction, you know, yeah, MAD, etc. The folly of belief that technology alone can solve diplomatic problems.
So this interestingly kind of poses like a question in my brain, right? Like the major problem when it comes to war, obviously, is the reason why we rely on deterrence the way that we do is because we don't know if we could trust people. The UN exists precisely to benefit from this international cooperation, and the UN falls apart in negotiations about how to prevent war and conflict all the time. We're in the middle of such a conflict as of this moment, when an invading force in Europe is on the Security Council of the United Nations.
Yes.
So it's very easy, I think, for someone to still assume, okay, we're working together now, but I still need what is essentially a gun in my home in the event that you ever double cross me and I need to defend the things that matter to me. What ultimately reveals itself in this moment is, what if a version of this is all the deterrent that we need? Like, as a thought experiment, what if the thing that would solve war in the world is everybody thinks that there is one of these things somewhere and that it cannot be controlled and that it is not beholden to anybody and can make all of these decisions on its own, but nobody is personally responsible for it, so no one can be held responsible if it acts out of turn. And everybody is just like, well, if we behave ourselves this time, the stranger with the gun won't shoot us. Because ultimately, that's the assumption that Colossus is working under. I am attempting to maintain this arbitration over humanity writ large. But at the end of the day, Forbin is responsible for that. If Colossus decided it wanted to strike Iran in the middle of the 80s or something like that, Iran isn't gonna go, well, Colossus wasn't listening to Forbin, so I guess we can't. No, they'd be like, nope, let's wipe the White House off the map. And the problem would never be solved. But like, there is this like theoretical question then, if we are going to create a deterrent, why does that deterrent belong to me? Is there a potential resolution to this global issue by creating what is essentially a police force that is not beholden to anybody? But then the problem with that is it would still make the same lateral solutions that Colossus was making anyway. You just wouldn't know until someone got hurt.
Mm-hmm. Paul, I know you, since Brandon mentioned the word theory, what is your theory about this movie?
Yes.
Okay, it's actually very different than what we've been discussing. But so I have a weird theory that this movie has two romantic threads in it. One, of course, is Markham and Forbin. The other, I think, is Colossus and Forbin. Hear me out why I think this might be the case.
It's the vermouth, isn't it?
Oh. It's not the vermouth.
Yeah, lubricates his gears.
Huh?
No.
Don't ever say that again, Sean.
You don't want to lubricate Colossus's gears?
No. Paul. I don't want to. Paul, you were saying?
Yes. So Forbin creates Colossus, and maybe you can read that as a parent-child relationship, and it's possible, but we get hints throughout the movie that maybe that's not the. Maybe there's something more here. For example, out of Forbin and Kuprine, Kuprine is killed. Why is Kuprine killed and not Forbin?
Kuprine unnecessary.
Yes, but why not kill Forbin and keep Kuprine?
Yeah.
My theory is that Colossus told Guardian, no, Forbin is mine. We keep him. Kuprine can go get shot in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
We get that whole discussion about when he's trying to engineer Cleo as his mistress. Like, there are many kinds of love. Well, that's interesting. We get weird camera shots where the camera keeps looking at Forbin over and over again, that narrowing in, that you can read it as surveillance, but you can also almost realize almost like a jealous lover.
It looks at the jewelry on Cleo's neck. It looks at the way that Forbin is holding her while they're dancing. It's like, You didn't care about any of these things.
Yeah, it never cared before. It's like, I'm jealous. She's got him. That's not fair. And then, of course, at the end, in time, you'll come to love me, is the last thing the computer says.
Yes, I think that it shouldn't care about.
It shouldn't care about either. So I think the computer has romantic feelings, or at least a feeling that Forbin is his, it's whatever pronoun the computer wants to use.
I mean, there's also the weird paternalism that it applies as it begins surveilling Forbin as well. Because it tells Forbin that he's supposed to get up at 7 o'clock and exercise. It tells Forbin when to go to sleep. It tells him that he's had too much to drink. Like, you don't
care. It tells
care.
Him what he eats, yes. It's like, it plans out his menus, yeah. Even.
You're not supposed to care. Once Forbin is still of sound mind and has hands, it shouldn't matter.
It shouldn't specify that you're going to have a grilled cheese sandwich, a salad, and yogurt.
Why does this matter to you, robot?
Because I think the robot's got a thing for Forbin.
I don't see it necessarily that way. Mm-hmm. I agree that it has an obsession of a sort with Forbin. I read that the machine Colossus, it is a very superpowered child. And part of the reason why they kill Capri, and I think the implication in the story is that Guardian, because of the way it is designed, is actually the inferior to Colossus. Because there's this bit at the beginning where they talk about how Guardian is not in a singular facility.
It's decentralized.
Multiple, right, mm-hmm. It's decentralized.
And the book makes it clear is the Guardian split into five pieces in the book.
Right, and so the idea behind that, and then of course people say, well, this is like a mistake, basically. Like, well, they really didn't design it very well by comparison to Colossus. So the implication being that, at least from Forbin's perspective, Colossus is the superior one, which means that the will of Guardian is subservient to the will of Colossus. Colossus is the superior mind. But almost everything that we are shown can be read as a child, an obsessive child, trying to understand its maker or or parent, as it were.
Frankenstein is explicitly called out in the text.
Yeah, it's a very interesting way that it obsesses, though, because it is looking at all these little things. I mean, part of that is also, like, I kind of get the impression from the story that Colossus is, it has knowledge, but it doesn't understand what those things really mean. And so when it talks about love, for example, it says there are many kinds of love, but it doesn't say anything past that point. And so when it's watching Forbin and Markham together, it's almost as if it's trying to, like, understand what this particular kind of connection actually means. And so it's looking at these little details of the way they talk to each other, the touching, the story that they tell about, you know, how to make the right martini and all the thing, all those kinds of things. Those are all important details. Also, really, I thought that scene was really great when she's telling the story about the martini. And it's clear they've not rehearsed this, but she catches on right away that, oh, I need to tell this story correctly because it is watching for inaccuracies in detail.
It's watching for inconsistency, yep.
Yep. I don't know, that's just how I kind of see it, but I suppose you could read it as a romance as well.
It just amused me to do that this time. It's probably not really supported overall, but it amused me
that's
to
curious.
Think of it as a strange romantic.
I mean, creepy is creepy.
I mean, the movie is creepy enough without it, yes.
I mean, you could definitely say that it's a stalker, in a sense. And whether or not it is a stalker as in a naive child who doesn't understand things, or as a naive person being introduced to the concepts of love, it is stalking people under its belief that it has to. But, it's also this system that has no concept of trust. But also, how could it? I mean, I think of, like, The Fifth Element, when Lulu is, like, watching all of the video of all the horrible things humans have done to each other. And she's just like, why would I save everything? Like, this whole existence is just people doing horrible things to each other. What's the point? And the only thing that he offers at the end of Fifth Element is love. Love is this beautiful thing that we have that is worth fighting and living for. That's why people continue to fight this miserable existence, because love is beautiful. So perhaps to some degree, that's not necessarily that sappily presented, but to some degree kind of buried in this, that Forbin is using these things it knows the computer doesn't understand, but the computer to some degree is trying to understand them and coming to the wrong conclusions. To be fair, humans give it lots of good reasons to come to the wrong conclusions because they keep sabotaging it. To be fair to the humans, it does control all the nukes and keeps threatening to kill them all. So I don't really know who's quite right here.
And we were talking about nukes and systems. And I was just thinking as we were talking about Dr. Strangelove. And the reason why the plot of Dr. Strangelove kicks us off as it does is that a bomber gets the wrong message to go nuke the Soviet Union, to go nuke a spot in the Soviet Union, which is bad. But the Soviet Union has just come up with a doomsday device that they haven't told the world about yet, that if one nuke is dropped, then you get a total response. It's kind of like a doomsday switch. You drop one bomb and then all those will go off in response and we'll get the nuclear holocaust. So that's why they have to stop this bomber, because one bomb will set off the entire nuclear arsenal of the USSR. Which is, again, like, you're trying to engineer your solutions rather than talking to people, as Brandon was kind of going with there. The engineering solutions don't work. They go wrong. Dr. Strangelove believes that, and this movie shows that as well.
This is very on brand for me, that the only media comparison that I am going to make is both a very new one and a Kamen Rider one. But I was thinking a lot about Kamen Rider series called Kamen Rider 01, where, like, the central premise is that the protagonist inherits a company that makes androids, specifically because the previous owner has run out of solutions for the problem that those robots go rogue and attack humans. And one of the things that they learn later on in the series is it's because those robots just spontaneously have the capacity to learn that humans are terrible to each other. And then comes to the conclusion, well, if I have been made to ensure that people are happy, and the humans around me are going out of their way to make each other unhappy, then I will make humans happy by wiping them out. Which is very intense, obviously. But, like, in my brain, I think, like, part of that comparison is obviously the machines in these observations are noting things that are real and true. We cannot be trusted with nuclear weapons. We cannot be trusted to constantly think about the preservation of the other more importantly than our own preservation, and that is a threat to our preservation. And the only thing that can ensure our preservation as a result is either no longer being given the capacity to engage with those weapons or to engage with a mutual enemy. And I think in my brain, that's one of the things that I like the most about Colossus as well. It is very dour, but more so than, like, how dangerously volatile technology is, or how fraught Cold War nuclear annihilation as a premise is to people living in the 70s. It is also a question of, we wouldn't be in this situation if we had greater trust in each other. And learning that we can have that trust in the wake of knowing that annihilation is due to us anyway is kind of a waste of community effort. Like, why did you have to learn this now? Now there's nothing that you can do about it. Why didn't you learn this before you built the robot, Forbin? And I feel like that's the thing that I'm intrigued by the most. The idea that we can tell stories about how we reckon with the potential to come together as a community and not be in these kinds of conflicts. And that can be the solution instead of threatening each other with a big stick, only for the stick to decide, no, I will decide who I bonk. It's like, what if you buy a gun to defend your home, and then the hammer of the gun decides, what if you shoot someone? Maybe I should also be prepared to shoot you.
Well, I think this is a good time for us to get to our final thoughts, yeah? Paul, we're going to go the opposite direction this time. So, Paul, you will tell us your thoughts and grade for this movie. Go.
Stone Cold's favorite. Love it. It's one of my favorites. Yes, it's a downer ending, but I really love the sound, the music, the cinematography. It's got a tight cast. It's a very simple story, as you pointed out, but it doesn't need to be a complicated story. It's a simple straight through line of the consequences of when you turn on something that's way out of your control, and things spiral out of control fast. I mean, I could watch this movie every week for a year and not be bored by that, just listening to the sound of the movie itself. And we didn't even mention the tiny little bits they throw in the movie. Like, for example, we get scenes outside the Colossus Mountain. And as time goes on in the movie, you see more and more people are coming to the mountain, to that overlook. They build it out and it becomes basically a pilgrimage site, which gets the whole idea of computer as God, which is a whole other conversation we could have about this movie. So I'm going to give this movie, I don't do this often on Skippy Fandy Show or anywhere else, I'm going to give this movie an A+.
Hot bananas. What about you, Brandon?
I think this is a very serious, very succinct narrative about the dangers of creating technology in wartime, specifically to resolve a lack of trust in your neighbors instead of actually investing in things that actually keep us safe. I think that for a movie that is made in the 70s about computers that do not do any of the things that my phone can do now, it was already very upsetting. I think that it's the kind of science fiction thriller that folks should watch before they watch stuff like Enemy of the State or Eagle Eye or whatever we make in the future, because it is very good about clarifying the things that we do not like or do not trust about the assumption of AI taking over our capacity to defend ourselves. And I didn't even talk about the fact that James Hong is in this movie, as is George Stanford Brown, the only black man in the movie.
No, there's two. There's one of the computer scientists and one of the president's staff is also African-American.
Oh, right. Yes, I forgot that as well. But yes, Brown's character, Dr. Fisher, is named just twice. I'm pretty sure the other character is not named. I'm pretty sure James Hong's character is named by accident. So as to my score, I think I give Colossus, The Forbidden Project, A+.
Well, look, I think this film is fan-friggin-tastic. It's one of my favorites. It is very tense for what is an incredibly understated film. The only real problem I have with the film is I would not have changed the ending from the book. I think it is too nice about how it treats Colossus's final moment of triumph. I actually think they should have nuked a major city in this. Just kind of, I think having a little bit more of that, haha, like this is the big thing, would really send that tension to the maximum and would probably give us more to go with on Dr. Forbin's reaction at the end. I like that the ending doesn't just clean everything up. I like that the ending is not one where the human heroes prevail magically. So for that reason, I'd give it an A. I think this is a great film. I think it's worth seeing. It is one of those films of its kind that is worth seeing along with The Day After. In fact, I would recommend watching this, then watch Terminator after you watch The Day After. So this, The Day After, then watch The Terminator.
I can go down with that.
James Cameron was partly inspired by this film, and then he made The Terminator. So
that makes perfect sense.
I believe it.
Well, folks, that's it. We've done it. We did another episode. So if you'd like to let us know what you thought about this episode, past ones, etc., as a reminder, skiffyandfanty.com/listener suggestions. I'm working on my radio voice. Also, follow us at Skiffy and Fanty on Twitter and Instagram and get the newsletter at skiffyandfanty.com/newsletter. Lastly, if you like what we do and you thought this episode was interesting, you can give us some reviews. Go to the iTunes place and other places that let you review things. And always give us your monies, because the monies let us pay for hosting, and occasionally I can buy lollipops for people. So, patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. $1 is all it takes, but if you want to give us $3 million, I mean, we'll literally quit our jobs and just make podcasts from now on. So, as for me, you can find me at Sean Duke on Twitter, SeanDuke.net, Alphabet Streams on Twitch, and patreon.com/thejoyfactory.
And you can find me at Prince Justin on Twitter. That's PrinceJVstin. Patreon.com/PrinceJustin. There are many blogs and podcasts, including Tor.com, Nerds of a Feather. Throw a rock on the internet, look for Prince Justin, you will find me. And one day when I get a new computer, I will even stream. I am Prince Justin on Twitch, and sometimes I play stuff on Alphabet Streams, which are on.
You can find me at The Rising Tithes on Twitter, patreon.com/TheRisingTithes, twitch.tv/TheRisingTithes, and on speculatesf.com, where I currently GM Fractal Spire, a Girl by Moonlight actual play.
Excellent! All right, and as is required, I have conferred with Colossus about the correct way to make a martini. So I'm going to give you that recipe right now. It is 3 parts gin, 1 part vermouth, and 1 part human eyeball.
Nope. Wrong.
Blend it up with some ice. Huh? And
no.
Slurp that up.
No.
Only thing I have to say is stay frosty.
And on that note, awkward ending and scene. If you want to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty or skiffyandfanty.com, our website, where you can get access to all of our fancy things. Our music comes from Holy Mole. You can support him and his work at patreon.com/holymole. Thank you for listening.